So welcome back, everybody. Hope you had a nice lunch. Time to chew over some food and also chew over maybe what we said this morning. So is there any questions you came up with maybe this morning while you had lunch? Because it seems like some of the people on internet have some questions. And main one here is by, I can't pronounce that. Venkatesh Lakshmi, what do you mean by Arahant? Yeah, we sometimes use some Pali words, as we said. Pali is this language that the Buddha spoke in. Sometimes we use that language because we're so familiar with it, and we don't realize that some people may not understand some of the words that we use. So apologies for that if we do that sometimes. So yeah, please point that out. And Arahant is one of those words. Arahant literally means somebody who is worthy, but it is used in a Buddhist context to refer to somebody who has really seen the truth and penetrated it to the full depth, and that somebody who has become enlightened, who has no more desire, no more anger, and no more misunderstanding about life. So that is the word Arahant we use for that. Yeah. And then can Ajahn Brahmali talk slower, please? Is another question. I don't know. I didn't find it too quick, but yeah. And then some others as well, but maybe not so relevant to dependent origination. So I'll just leave.
I think that one is a good one, because maybe Ms. we should take more breaks or something in between that.
We don't have time to think is another comment. So maybe we'll see about what we can do about that. It seems like things are getting interesting here with the IT. Okay. So, this morning we spoke about the early Buddhist texts and how they relate to dependent origination and what dependent origination is. Ajahn Brahmali gave a little, very brief overview of it. We'll go into much more detail later. But I thought before we look in more detail and get sort of into the nitty-gritty kind of stuff, maybe we should ask first why dependent origination? Why did the Buddha teach this? So you see here this cartoon of a man. He's eating a book that says the high fiber book. So, or the high fiber diet says on the cover, and he's eating that. So this man clearly, he has the instructions of how to eat a high fiber diet, but he doesn't apply them very well. he eats the book, and if we are not careful about dependent origination, we could do something very similar. We could try to understand all these concepts too intellectually, and we don't read them as in proper instructions and apply them. Like if you have a high fiber diet book, of course you take the recipes in the high fiber diet book and you cook the recipes and you eat them. You don't eat the book. That is silly. But, and it dependent origination, if you're not careful, you can also be silly, because you have to sort of apply the recipe to your life. You have to take these factors of dependent origination, these teachings, and sort of cook them up and see how you can use them. Yeah? And don't take them too literally, because if you take things literally, you can get into a lot of trouble. Like this man, here's another joke here, like this man who was driving on the road one day, and he saw a truck at the side of the road, and the truck was broken down. The truck driver stood looking at the engine, it's not working. And the man stopped, and he asked the truck driver, what's going on? And the truck driver said, well, I've got some penguins in the back of the truck. I'm going to take them to the zoo. Here, I'll give you some money if you take the penguins to the zoo for me. All right, the man, says the man, and he goes away, drives away. Later, the truck driver fixes the truck, and he drives towards the zoo. And as he arrives at the zoo, he sees the man walking out, but behind him, all the penguins are waggling behind him as well. And the truck driver said, what? I gave you money to bring these penguins to the zoo, and you're taking them out. He said, yeah, you gave me money to take the penguins to the zoo, but we have some leftovers, and now we're going to get some ice cream. So that's another example of not understanding the instruction. The instruction is take the penguins to the zoo. Of course, the implication is you leave them there. Yeah? You don't take them back out again. So that little joke to illustrate to you to not misunderstand some of these instructions in dependent origination. Because actually next week we will address some common misconceptions that exist. But for now, let's just have a look at why the Buddha taught dependent origination. So why? Because that's an important question to ask, yeah? We know now what it is, where it comes from, like the early Buddhist texts. But why? Because if we don't know why would you care, right? If there's no good reason. So let's have another quick look at what dependent origination actually is. And before I go to the next slide, actually, I should address that these early Buddhist texts that we mentioned earlier, they were not in English, of course. English didn't exist yet at the time of the Buddha. They used different languages. Mainly the one we use is Pali. So when people translate Pali into English, they sometimes use different words for the same Pali term. And so there is sometimes some slight disagreement on how to translate things. Sometimes people agree with the general idea, but they just use different words to translate certain terms. And this can both be a problem and can be helpful as well. It can be a problem because it can be a bit confusing sometimes. One person uses this term, another person uses another term. And actually, in our presentation, you will sometimes also find that we use different terms for the same word. That is, the same word in Pali we translate sometimes in different ways. Sometimes because we just copied somebody else's translations. Sometimes because we want to look at something from a slightly different angle. So just a tiny warning about that. There's sometimes some slightly different translations in our slides. Yeah, and if it gets too confusing, just point it out to us, and we'll try to be better. But it can also be helpful, the different translations. That's actually partly why we did this, because different English translations allows us to look at these Pali texts from different angles. It's hard to get your head around this when if you're not a translator, but there's almost never a perfect translation for a certain word. Yeah? Even from Dutch, which is my native language, into English, for many words, there's no perfect translation. But those languages are very close together, Dutch and English. A Pali and English are very much further apart, and are in both in time and linguistically in terms of words and stuff. So there's never a perfect translation, but we try to do our best, as do all translators. Would you say would you agree with that?
I agree.
Oh, good. All right, so before we go to why dependent origination, a quick repetition of what it is. And these are the Buddha's words translated into English. I'll just read it out. So what is dependent origination? Dependent on ignorance, there are willed acts. Dependent on willed acts, there is consciousness. Dependent on consciousness, there are the mental aspects and form of a being, what we earlier translated as name and form. Dependent on the mental aspects and form of a being, there are the six senses. Dependent on the six senses, there are the sense impressions. Dependent on the sense impressions, there are sensations. Dependent on sensation, there's craving. Depending on craving, there is fuel or taking up. Those are both valid translations for the word which is upadana there. We'll come back to that again. Dependent on fuel or taking up, there is life. Dependent on life, there is birth. And dependent on birth, there come to be old age and death and sorrow, grief, pain, sadness and distress. That is how this whole mess of suffering originates. And then the text continues with how it all comes to cease as well. Suffering comes to cease. But we focus on the origination for now. And as Ajahn Brahmali very rightly pointed out this morning, you see those factors or those words and you're like, I don't get this at all. When I first read this a long time ago, I was like, what is this about? What is this about? This doesn't sound like the Buddha even, because many suttas, they are so clear. You read them and you understand what it is about. It's, for example, about doing good acts and you get happy as a result. That's very clear. Or sometimes the Buddha just tells little stories about farmers or priests or whatever. He just tells their stories and they're very clear. You get the idea. But this seems very confusing to me. Who also thinks this is confusing? Raise your hand. Yeah, someone hesitant, but maybe you people have studied this more than we may assume. But if something is confusing, you look for an explanation. So what did I do as a layperson when I first found these kind of things? There was internet already, so I started dependent origination on the internet, on Google. Google knows everything, right? So I type it in, and what do I get? I get things like this. Wow! That doesn't make it any clearer at all. Another Google search, another. And I get things like this. Wow! Now I'm really confused. And now I'm really like this. What? I am so confused. Is it really so technical as those slides that I just showed you? Is that right? Is that Buddhism? What do you think? Does that feel like this is the way the Buddha would explain something with all sorts of arrows and that kind of thing? I don't think so. To me, that's my personal opinion. But it seems to be this this vibe or this idea around dependent origination that it is somehow much more complex than everything else the Buddha taught. That seems to be this idea around. That's what I feel anyway. And like, okay, the rest is easy stuff. But this dependent origination, this is really something totally else. And to give you an example of those kind of ideas, I'll read you two of them out. Some common views here. So while the Four Noble Truths are not considered to be a difficult doctrine, the dependent origination formula has been held throughout Buddhist history to be profound and difficult. This is not the Buddha I'm quoting here. This is some scholar who wrote this. It's not us, just somebody else. I can't remember exactly, but you get here the idea. The Four Noble Truths are not so difficult, but dependent origination is really profound and difficult. Okay. Let's just remember that quote for now. And then another one. Dependent arising, which is another name for dependent origination. This is one of those different translations that I talked about earlier. Dependent arising is not merely one strand of doctrine, but the radical insight at the heart of the Buddha's teaching, the insight from which everything else unfolds. It's not merely one strand. It's like something, you know, it's not part of it. Dhamma almost, it seems, sounds like sometimes. So let's just keep this quote in mind and see if this is true. And Let's look at it from the perspective of the early Buddhist texts. And who knows what may be the earliest Buddhist text or the earliest sutta, the earliest teaching of the Buddha? Who has been to the sutta classes and has been paying attention? Do you know the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta? The sutta setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma, the first teaching the Buddha gave. The very first teaching when he was teaching the first monk's disciples. Just after his enlightenment, he started teaching. And what did he teach? The four truths, the four noble truths. I like to translate it as, not as noble truths, but as truths seen by somebody who is noble. That's a slight difference there, but I'll come back to that later. So this is not actually, this is not the first sutta. The first sutta I'll come back to in a moment. This is something saying something about those four noble truths. And it goes like this. The footprint of all animals fit inside that of an elephant. Therefore, the elephant's footprint is called the king of all footprints. Likewise, all skillful teachings, the teachings of the Buddha, can be included in the four truths seen by the Noble One, or the Four Noble Truths. What are those four? The truth of suffering, the truth of the origin of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the practice that makes the suffering cease. This is the last one, is the Noble Eightfold Path. This is Sariputta who said this. And so what Sariputta is saying here, Sariputta being this, what Ajahn Brahmani called the right-hand disciple of the Buddha, he is saying here that everything that that is a good teachings of the Buddha or of his disciples, they can all be included within the Four Noble Truths. Yeah. So what we saw before, this scholar saying Four Noble Truths are simple, but dependent origination is really difficult. Well, that doesn't make sense in this context if they are included in one another, right? All the skillful teachings can be included in the Four Truths. And you see there next to it, there an elephant's footprint. It's not very clear maybe on the projector, but an elephant's footprint, and you see the human footprint fits right inside. So like similarly to that, all the Buddhist teachings fit inside these Four Noble Truths. Yeah, that gives us some idea of some context for all the teachings. And just as a footnote, why I don't translate it commonly, the common translation for what I translated as the Four Truths seen by a Noble One, the common translation is Noble Truths. This is a little awkward thing about Pali, that sometimes you can have these multiple meanings in a single word. And they're probably both right, in a sense, Noble Truths and Truth seen by a Noble One. Noble One being somebody who understands to some extent the Buddha's teachings, who has some insight on a personal level, not just intellectual. And I don't like to translate noble truth, because the first truth is the truth of suffering. What is noble about suffering? I don't know. You get the idea that the suffering doesn't sound very noble to me. But if you see suffering as a noble one, that makes more sense. But anyway, that's a slight footnote. So these four noble truths, they are really the cornerstone of the Buddha's teachings. That's what everything sort of evolves around, what everything should fit into. So what are these four noble truths? We just see them here very briefly, but the sutta I mentioned earlier, setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma, the Buddha's first discourse, that is where he explains them in more detail, and that is this sutta. The Buddha's first discourse. And the first noble truth, he explains what suffering is, or some aspects of suffering. The truth of suffering is the following. Birth is suffering. Old age is suffering. sickness is suffering, death is suffering, and then there's a few other things that are suffering, but my slide got a bit too long, so I just cut that out. In short, the five aspects of existence, which are taken up, these are the five khandhas for those who have heard about that before, they are suffering. So the Buddha is really saying that life is suffering, really. You get born, then you live, the five aspects of existence, yeah? And then old age is suffering, then you get sick. Not everybody has old age, of course, some people die young, but it's just in general, people get old first before they die. This is a problem, right? This is the problem Buddha starts out. This is the first thing he taught. And where does this suffering comes from? The truth, this is the second noble truth, the truth of the origin of suffering is the following. It is the craving that leads to a next life. It's this tanha punabhavika in Pali. And I've underlined that because that's really a very important message, and I'll come back to that. Which, along with enjoyment and desire, it's a synonym for craving, looks for happiness in all kinds of things. So, and that is to say, the craving for sense pleasures, the craving to exist, and the craving to annihilate yourself. It's craving, the Buddha says here, which is the cause of suffering. Well, not any craving, actually. He's being very specific here and saying it's a craving that leads to a next life, a craving that leads to a rebirth, which causes the suffering. Yeah? It's not all the craving. Sometimes you can crave things and they don't create too much of a problem for you, but the craving that leads to rebirth, that is a big, big, big problem. Because then you get all this birth again, this old age and sickness, and you have to go through it all again. But, luckily, there's a solution to all this, and in which Buddhism can sometimes be called a negative religion, because we talk about suffering all the time. Where is your happiness? Oh, as you may have noticed, the monks are very happy, and so are many of you. All of you, hopefully, are very happy people. So Buddhism is not all about suffering. Clearly, it's about happiness as well. And that is where these next noble truths come in, the third and the fourth. The truth of the cessation of suffering is the following. Cessation of suffering. That sounds interesting to me. It is the complete cessation, fading away, relinquishment, giving up, non-existence and non-abiding of that very same craving. The complete cessation of that same craving. The same craving refers back to the second noble truth. It means the craving that leads to a next life. If you don't have that kind of craving, or you don't have craving at all then that will lead to a cessation of suffering. This is what to the person who asked the question before about an arahant. What is an arahant? Well, that is somebody who don't have this craving anymore. Who is craving has the complete cessation of this kind of craving. Does that sound good to you? Yeah? To not be chasing around things all the time that just lead to suffering? Sounds pretty promising to me. And this is a nice message by the Buddha. The cessation of craving, that was what leads to the cessation of suffering. Often we try to find a cessation of suffering by trying to replace something in our life. Maybe your marriage is not working. I'll just get another one. Another wife, another husband, whatever. Yeah, this is a normal way for us to deal with suffering. Or you're sick. And what do you do? I am so sick. I want to be happy. I want to be healthy. My stupid body is always sick. And you're craving to be healthy. And this is another way that we usually deal with things. Huh? Or you're poor and you're suffering from not having enough money, which is a very serious problem. I don't want to brush these kind of problems under the carpet, but what is the usual thing people do when they are poor? I wish I had more money. That's That is the usual reaction when they start craving things. And this is very natural. And this is something almost everybody would have. And I just gave you some examples of that. But you can probably relate this to things in your own life. You're at work and you want to be home. And you're at home and then you want to be at work again. So, but the Buddha says, look at this craving, yeah, and try to see if it can come to an end. And that will lead you to a cessation of suffering. And how that works in more detail, we'll see later. But then the fourth noble truth is the point four on the slide. The Buddha is explaining the truth of the practice that makes suffering cease, as seen by the Noble One. That is the following. It's the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is the Noble Eightfold Path is the training that we do as Buddhists. This is the fourth noble truth, the training that we do to try and reach the cessation of suffering. And in this course, we will be talking a lot about dependent origination and dependent cessation. Of course, that's the title of this course. And one aspect that we may slightly miss because of this is the fourth noble truth. Because dependent origination and dependent cessation, they are not really included in the fourth noble truth. They are more the second and the third noble truth. So sometimes we miss, for example, the practice of meditation is not directly mentioned in dependent origination, right? Remember those factors that we saw before? There was nothing like meditation in there or virtue or these kind of things that we connect with the Buddhist path, because these are more included under the fourth noble truth. So here, the Buddha's first discourse. And I've underlined those two very important lines. The craving that leads to a next life, that is what leads to suffering. But the cessation of that craving, that leads to the cessation of suffering. So, craving, if you have craving, it leads to rebirth, certain kinds of craving. And that, if you're reborn, and there will be suffering again, because even the process of birth itself is suffering, not only for the mother, but also for the baby, right? So that's why the Buddha said birth is suffering. And then if you have no craving, then you have no rebirth, and then there will be no suffering. These are, in very short terms, the second and third noble truths explained. Can everybody see that? That in this pink box, I have sort of summarized very briefly the second and third noble truth. Is that clear? Yeah? Okay, because that's sort of the major thread I'm going to take throughout this little presentation, is that it's sort of all these teachings of dependent origination, they come down to this principle. So craving leads to rebirth, leads to suffering. No craving, no rebirth, no suffering. So this, the Buddha's first discourse, he gave this to the first monks, disciples. And some of you I know have been to Dhamma talks before and to Sutta classes. So about this discourse, I have a pop quiz. Yes, there are no bonus points to be gathered by this, but the pop quiz. Are you ready? Get your maybe you're getting a bit drowsy from lunch, so get your mind working again. I've got a cup of tea myself.
It's over here.
Yep. Tea. Pop quiz. What happened when the Buddha gave this teaching, by that teaching I mean the Four Noble Truths that we've seen before? Remember, this was the Buddha's very first teaching. What happened? Matthew is smiling because I told him before, and he actually got it. I was testing it on him. Yeah, Prem. Yeah. Prem has an idea. What do you think, Prem? Yes, that is excellent. I'm very happy about that, because what happened? While this talk was given, Venerable Kondanya had the stainless, I'm quoting the sutta here, had the stainless, spotless insight into the truth, into the Dhamma. He saw that whatever may originate, it's all bound to cease. Do you see what happened here? The Buddha just gave this very quite simple teaching, the one that we saw before, that this scholar said, oh, the Four Noble Truths, they're easy. But dependent origination is really difficult. But what happened? The Buddha taught just the Four Noble Truths, and this Venerable Kondanya, he saw whatever may originate is all bound to cease. He saw all dependent origination. All right, origination and cessation. He understood. He understood it. Without having to be taught all those complicated links about the ignorance and the willed acts and all those things. He never heard of those before, because what was before was the Buddha's first teaching. And still he got it. Isn't that cool? I'm pointing that out because maybe some of you are the next Venerable Kondanya. Don't laugh! I really think that. It can be true. You may think, oh, I need to understand all these factors. I need to read more books. I need to understand all about the pin origination. I need to take notes of these classes. But maybe that's not the way that people understand the Dhamma. Yeah? If you were here for a last night talk by Ajahn Brahm, he started out his talk by talking about the difference between intellect and insight, and how we hopefully can teach things from a practical perspective, from a perspective, I think he called it, of truth, and not of just books and intellectual ideas. So what Kondanya had here was not an intellectual idea about dependent origination. He didn't see all those 12 factors. That was very nicely pointed out by Ajahn Bamali. If you have this insight, it's just summarized here, whatever may originate in it. That means whatever suffering he may still experience, that is all bound to cease. Because he understood the way to end suffering. And Ajahn Brahmani said rightly, when you have this kind of insight, it's not like you are just meditating there and suddenly somebody shouts in your ear, ignorance leads to willed acts, or something. That's not how your insight happens. You know, you don't hear the words, or you don't see them in front of your eyes. It's much deeper than that. It's beyond words. The Dhamma, the truth by the Buddha, is beyond words. It's even beyond whatever may originate, it's all bound to cease. Even those are just words to point out something much deeper. Yeah. The Four Noble Truths, even. They're called truths, but then explaining the deeper truth. Does this make sense to everybody? That we cannot find the truth in words. We have to find truth somewhere much deeper, inside of ourselves, inside of life. Yeah? So again, I'm really inspired by this Venerable Kondanya fellow, that he was able to understand things so quickly. He was the first one after the Buddha to understand these things, at least in this current era, let's call it an era. The first one after the Buddha. And the Buddha was really, it seems like he was almost surprised by it. Because at the end of the sutta, the Buddha says, wow, Kondanya understood it. The Buddha was almost like, wow, I didn't expect that to happen. He may have been a bit skeptical about people's abilities, but maybe people are much more able than even the Buddha thought it. It seems that way anyway when I read the sutta. Anyway, the main point of this, to take away from this, that maybe you don't need to know so much Dhamma. Maybe the Four Noble Truths is enough for you. Who knows? What do you think, Ajahn Brahmani?
Yeah. Do you think we should unlearn something? Do we have, if we learn too much, should we kind of take it out? What do you reckon?
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So what's the best way of doing that?
To let it all go.
Let it all go?
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes maybe you get a bit too much stuck into... At least I recognize that in myself. Sometimes get a bit too stuck into the intellectual side of things.
Yeah. I think that sometimes one of the things about learning the Dhamma in a more intellectual way is that when you see the teachings coming together nicely and you see how it all fits together, it can lead to a sense of confidence in the teachings of the Buddha, because you see how it all, it's like this kind of jigsaw puzzle where every aspect kind of coheres with the other aspects and all fits together into this nice picture. Yeah. I think if you use it wisely rather than purely intellectually, then it can be actually quite useful. But but you have to kind of, you're quite right, you have to use it in a wise way. Yeah.
Yes, the Buddha didn't teach the Panda origination for no reason. That's sort of what you're sort of saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't just teach it to be intellectual. Of course, he had some reasons to teach it. We'll address those later. Everybody still with me? Right, next, an example of the same principle on the next slide. We've seen this before. Ajahn Brahmali quoted this before. This is Sariputta speaking. He says, the Lord Buddha said, if you see dependent origination, you see the truth, the Dhamma. If you see the truth, you see dependent origination. This is very, very, very often quoted by people who are going to explain dependent origination. They say, if you see the truth, then you see this. Then often they quote this and then they continue with those 12 links that we've seen before. You may recognize this if you've read some of those kind of explanations. But actually, if you look at this sutta, it's not explained that way at all. It just continues like this. And what has dependently originated are these five aspects of existence. We will explain that later, which is called khandhas in Pali, which are taken up. Wanting them, adhering to them, being attracted to them and holding on to them, that will make suffering originate. Removing and abandoning the want and desire for them, that will make suffering cease. Does this sound familiar? This is another way to explain those four noble truths we've seen before. Yeah? Because there we see the craving leading to the rebirth, leading to suffering. And the rebirth is basically the origination of the five aspects of existence. Maybe I should briefly mention the five aspects of existence is like aspects of life, really. And it includes our body, it includes what we call consciousness, and it includes the will and what we call feelings and perceptions. So that's basically what makes up the human body. Those are what are dependently originated. We've seen before those are what are defined as suffering. So there we have the first noble truth. Wanting them, adhering to them, and being attracted to them, etc., that will make suffering originate. This is like saying craving is what leads to these things. And in the third noble truth, and removing and abandoning the want and desire for them, that will make suffering cease. So we have here again the same principle. A craving leads to rebirth, leading to suffering. Not having that craving, there's no rebirth, there's no suffering. It may just be just me, but I find it quite interesting that Sariputta here speaks about the dependent origination. If you see that, you see the truth. This is the insight that Kondanya had. But then he explains it. He doesn't explain it in what we would maybe call a traditional way. He explains it in a much, maybe what you could call a simpler way. We don't find these factors of name and form, etc. here. Just re-explains the principle, craving leading to rebirth, leading to suffering. No craving, no rebirth, no suffering. That is also here an explanation of dependent origination. but in a much different slant to it, right? Yeah. So we can already see here that Sariputta here, quoting the Buddha, is approaching the same subject from a slightly different angle. And now the point I'm trying to get at here is that all those teachings of dependent origination, which may seem very difficult at first, and that people actually call difficult and profound, is yet another way of looking at this same principle, the same noble truths, the same principle that craving leads to rebirth, leads to suffering, no craving, no rebirth, no suffering. That is really like the essence of dependent origination. It's a bit deeper than that, though. And that is one of the things that Ajahn Brahmali mentioned before, is this Buddhist idea that we have. Well, it's not really an idea, it's the truth of things, of what we call non-self, or in Pali the word is anatta. And non-self means, very briefly, means that inside of us there is no real permanent essence. They sometimes call this also the empty of a self, or empty of a soul. It means that what we think may be a continuous process. I was born, then I grew older, then I grew even older, then I learned things, then I played, then I got older and I went to university, I became a monk. I, that idea of I, and you have all your own stories about life, that idea, that is an idea of a self or an essence inside of us. But the Buddha said that that idea is wrong, because such an essence doesn't exist. We are not in control of life. We are not the same person that we were when we were born. And it's not the same person that we are now. And it's not the same person that we are tomorrow. This is a very, very deep concept that goes together with seeing dependent origination. It's two sides of the same coin, almost. And in this sutta, it's also pointed, it's also addressing this thing of non-self, of there being no real, nothing permanent inside of us. Everything keeps always changing. Because here it mentions these five aspects of existence, these five khandhas, as being dependently originated. And these five khandhas, these are one way of explaining that there is no self in us, because these khandhas are the consciousness, which is continually changing. Our perception of things is never the same. It arises, and then it changes, it ceases, and another perception arises, or another consciousness arises. And the same with the will. That is one of these khandhas as well. We might think we are in control of our life, but are we really? Or are we more like a tree in a forest? A tree doesn't decide, I'm going to grow a branch here, or I'm going to grow a branch here, or I'm going to stand in this place. A tree just grows, and they just live their life. They're not deciding on things. Why would a life of human or of an animal be much different? Isn't it, maybe it's the case that we just grow like a tree, our life just unfolds without us being in control. We'll come back to this later, because this is actually also part of dependent origination when we talked about these willed acts. Yeah, willed acts. They are dependently originated. They're not something we make. It's a law of nature for our will to behave in certain ways. It's another word that we've seen before. They are conditioned. So they're not ours. This is really scary to realize that you're not really in control of life. You may decide when you walk out of the door here later, decide to go right or decide to go, this is right for you, right or left outside of the door. But is that really a decision, or is this just automatic? You just follow your habits. And what I'm trying to say here, everything we do in life is not really a decision, although it sometimes seems like that. That's an illusion. That is, and as we said before, an avidya. But we'll go into this in much more depth later on, so let me just move on for now. Yeah.
Would you like to see if there's any questions or comments from the...
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah. That's a good point here. Yeah. Any questions? No questions. All right. That means you either understood it all, and I'm a really good teacher, or you got nothing out of it, and are now afraid to ask a question. There's actually a question here. Just wait for the microphone for a second. Sorry.
So obviously there must be some sort of boundary between decision and non-decision. Right now I made decision to ask a question. Do you, are you saying that I haven't made that decision? You can hear my question.
This is a good question. You say, I decided to ask a question. Or I decided not to ask a question. What is common in between those two options? Is the I decided or I did not decide. I'm not saying there are no decisions. There are decisions, it's obvious. But this I behind the decisions, this is what the Buddha says is an illusion. And so, we'll go into more depth, I think, later on. Who asked the question? My name is Sunyo. And Sunyo means empty.
Doesn't exist.
So, sorry? Okay. Yeah, sure.
Bhante, that when the question came, did I ask the question or did I not ask the question? I think probably what you were saying, Bhante, was that we don't have the control. That what the Buddha has said, you said we are like a tree or we are like a robot. And I think what happened was, it was not the control in my view, it is the conditioning. Because you conditioned us in my view, to ask that question. It's not my asking. It's not me asking. It's not me coming here. Yeah. This thing. It's he conditioned me now to ask that question. Bhante, you conditioned him and he conditioned me. So that's how I look at it. I think, am I right, Ajahn?
We mentioned the word conditioning before. This is a very important aspect of Buddhism, that things don't happen out of nothing. They are all related, and like decisions are conditioned by other things. Yeah? Many of our decisions, and this is part of dependent origination, are conditioned by the way we think about things. If we think in terms of having a lot of greed, then we tend to make decisions that are in line with that. We decide to go after things that we know are not so good for us, you know. Maybe you watch too much television, you have so much greed for watching television, or you take too much ice cream for lunch or whatever. This is just a small example of how greed conditions our decisions. Conditioning, that's the important thing. Yeah. All right.
Could you please
Where? Oh, there. Ah, Prem.
Elaborate on the five aspects of existence, Kandas, please, at this time.
I think that's better to do that later, because these are really also part of
Okay, thank you.
But it's a good question, and the problem sometimes with explaining this teaching is that they're all interrelated, as Ajahn Brahmali called it earlier, like a puzzle that fits together, and sometimes we take one piece and it fits together with other pieces, but we, in explaining one topic like this sutta here, explaining this one, we sort of imply other teachings as well, and they're all related to each other. So for example, the khandhas, and it's sometimes hard to find a baseline where to start from that everybody understands all the terms that we mention. Right? Do you get what I'm saying here? Because the suttas are so related to each other, there's so many terms that are explained in other suttas sometimes. Like these khandhas are explained elsewhere, not in this sutta. So, but we can't give you a proper teaching all the time explaining every term whenever we come across some new term. But we will go through it later. Yeah. All right, so we've seen before, just to come back to the slide here, we've seen before some of the factors of dependent origination, and we've seen some of the Four Noble Truths. And I'll just show you those again. We have here, you see the list of some factors of dependent origination that we have seen a few times. We have seen craving. Remember that one in the list of the factors? You have the taking up, which is the word is upadana, and it also means fuel. But for now, let's just keep with taking up. And then there's the factor of life and birth and old age and death. Those are five factors of dependent origination. In total, there are 12 factors, but I just took these five out. Because why did I do that? Because these are actually already explained in the those noble truths, those teachings the Buddha gave in his very first discourse. For example, craving is mentioned there at the bottom. You see, in the second noble truth, the origin of suffering is the craving that leads to a next life. The taking up is also mentioned because those five khandhas are which we take up. And so we also have the word taking up is also there. The word life, this is bhava, is also there. It's craving that leads to a next life. The word for birth is also there. And old age and death, also. So what we get here is that in the first two noble truths already, five of the factors of dependent origination that are five factors that are in a sequence are already mentioned. So in fact, we see here that dependent origination is just a part of those truths, as I said before. And now, dependent origination is taught in slightly different ways throughout the suttas. We've seen before this very long list of 12 factors, but there are simpler, quote-unquote, versions of dependent origination, and one of them is the following. This is a simpler version of dependent origination. When you focus on the gratification of things, craving increases. Dependent on craving, there is the fuel or the taking up. Dependent on the fuel or the taking up, there is life. Dependent on life, there's birth. Dependent on birth, there come to be old age and death, and sorrow, grief, pain, sadness and distress. That is how this whole mess of suffering originates. You see, this is very similar to the first slide that I showed you. That started with a long list of factors, but here we have only those few. Yet this is still a complete teaching in itself. This is just... would it be possible to close those windows, maybe? Or it's getting louder and louder, it seems. I don't know if it's possible.
Yay.
Oh, yeah, that's much, much better. Yeah. So it's interesting that the Buddha didn't always teach dependent origination in the same way. We've seen before that those Four Noble Truths are one way, actually, of this explaining this principle, because when the Buddha explained the Four Noble Truths, then Venerable Kodanya, he understood it already. And here we have a slightly more expanded version of those Noble Truths. We have starting with craving, and it leads to the suffering, to the old age and death. That is how this whole mess of suffering originates, from starting with craving here. It doesn't start with ignorance. It starts with craving.
Wait, are you going to move on?
Yeah, you can.
May I interject a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
You sure? Okay. I just want to take a little bit of a sidetrack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Happy to.
Okay. You know, okay. Yeah. if you go to Thailand and you visit Ajahn Gana, he says, okay. It's very sweet, yeah, and as a monk you're supposed to be a little bit sweet, so I say also, okay. That's not the sidetrack, by the way, the sidetrack comes now. So what is interesting about what Venerable Sunyo is showing here is that here we have a version of dependent origination which only has five factories, yeah? And this is very interesting because one of the, I think, really important points that he was making before is that the dependent origination is contained within the second and the third noble truth. The second noble truth is the arising of suffering. And the arising of suffering comes from craving. And the expanded formula of that is dependent origination. It goes beyond craving. It takes it all the way back to ignorance, to avidya, as we have seen before. And then you have the cessation of suffering is the ending of avidya, going all the way to the ending of suffering as a consequence. So what is fascinating here is that when we talk about dependent origination, it occurs in so many different versions in the suttas. The standard version is the 12 links, so the 12 factors we have seen before. There are versions that have 10 links. There are versions that have 9 links. Here we have a version that has 5. There are other versions that have 7 or 8 links. So what is dependent origination? How do we decide how many links are required for it to be called dependent origination? At what point is it no longer dependent origination? If I say one link, death, is that dependent origination? It's a bit too little. It's not enough, yeah? If you only have death, it can't be dependent origination because you have to have some kind of dependency. It needs at least two factors, maybe birth leading to death. But is that enough? How do we decide what is sufficient for something to be called dependent origination? It's a very, I think, very important and very interesting idea because very often we will hear people say this is dependent origination, but is it really dependent origination? A classical example of that is what in the suttas is known as the sequence of perception. How does perception arise? How do we get input in the world? How do we experience the world? And usually in the suttas it is said that you have the eye, you have form. Yeah, in other words, you have the sense organ, and then you have the external forms that the sense organ sees. Depending on those two, you have consciousness arising. With these three coming together, the eye, the form, and consciousness coming together, is called sense impression, or contact is often translated. From contact, you have feeling. And then sometimes it says from feeling, you have perception. From perception, you have thought. From thought, you have papancha. I'm talking about papancha later on. It's a nice word, right? Papancha. Do you like that word? What do you think it means? It's almost implied in the word. Papancha means like mental proliferation. The idea that you think about things. The mind just gets out of control. Thinking, papancha. It sounds a bit like what it actually means. The sound is almost right. And this sequence, you will notice that it has the Vedana is there, the feeling is there,
the contact is there. Yeah, it has some of the aspects of dependent origination. But is it dependent origination? Many people will argue this in itself is dependent origination. But it misses things like rebirth, right? So is it really dependent origination? So how do we decide? I think this is really crucial, critically important for us to understand at what point we are reading about this particular teaching here. And the answer is to go back to the third or the second noble truth. If you go to the second noble truth, we know that dependent origination is an expansion of that. So what are the critical factors? And this is one of the things Venerable Sunya has been pointing to again and again and again. The critical factors is craving, yeah, which is the source of suffering. You could also argue maybe defilements, or you could argue avidya, yeah, or craving, one of those things, a source. Then it goes to rebirth. Then it goes to suffering. That is what the second noble truth says. So the answer is that for something to be called dependent origination, it has to have at least those three factors. Yeah? It has to have the source of the suffering, then it has to have the rebirth aspect, and then it has to have the suffering aspect. Any sequence which contains those three in a causal connection, cause-wise connection, that can be called dependent origination. And that gives you a very handy rule of thumb to apply, and it gives you a way of being able to evaluate when someone comes and tells you, now this is dependent origination, yeah? You say, wait a minute, does it actually have these particular elements to it? And if it doesn't, it is not going to be the dependent origination of the Buddha. It might be the dependent origination of someone else, but if you want to hear about the dependent origination of the Buddha, then the dependent origination of someone else might not be so interesting, yeah? Let's go back to the EBTs, the early Buddhist texts. What did the Buddha have to say about this? Anyway, I just wanted to throw that in there while you were on this particular topic. So
yeah, I didn't think there was a sidetrack at all, because it sort of implies what I'm trying to say, that dependent origination can be taught in different ways. As you say, there's a five-factor, a six-factor teachings in different suttas. It's explained in different ways. But yeah, you have to have these rebirth process in there. Oh, thank you. Yeah. That's
Okay.
Maybe. What? This is probably better for Ajahn Bhamani, because he may know more about this. So I'll ask it to you. From Paul Westbury, what is the earliest dependent origination found from archaeology? Is it found in Gandhara?
Is it found in the Gandharan suttas? I'm not aware that it is found there. I don't really know what the earliest one is. I know that there are Sanskrit suttas that have dependent origination, but they are much later. They are part of, but they're, you know, they're still at least probably over 1,000 years old, so they're still old. But I think maybe the earliest one is the one that Venerable Sunya was talking about before, which was found on the gold inscriptions in Burma. That goes back to roughly the 4th century. That's pretty ancient, 4th century, 1600 years or something like that. But I'm not aware of any, personally, I'm not aware of the dependent origination found in the very earliest manuscripts from Gandhara. Yeah.
Another question from, that's not a name, from the Fiugutano or something. Well, whatever that is, hello. So how do we cultivate good qualities? Is our effort to cultivate also out of our control? I knew people were going to be interested in this no control question. There's no will issue. There's no control the will issue. So I was sort of reluctant to start talking about it, because I knew it was going to create some little tangents, but it's all right. So is our effort to do good also out of our control, or is it only the bad things that are out of control? Ajahn Brahm, in his talks, he often says that he is the brainwasher. He brainwashes us, he says. I'm brainwashing my monks, I'm brainwashing my lay people. But people who have listened to him, they will probably recognize this. And what he means by that is, he is imprinting on our minds certain ideas. He is conditioning us. He is making us think in certain ways by the things he says. And the way we act, if we act good, it's not because we decide suddenly one day, oh, this is the good way to do it. It's because somebody has taught us, better be kind, better be gentle. Well, we may have some inert tendencies as well to be good, but those are also not in our control. So our effort to do good also comes from outside of us, in a sense. It's also conditioned. And this is actually a good thing, because it means the more you listen to good teachings, the more you read about morality, about meditation, and the more you listen to talks, the more your mind is like programmed to do those kind of things. Those kind of ideas about meditation and good behavior, they will come up more frequently the more you listen to talks. It's not that we decide. There's no essence inside that controls our decision. That's the point I'm trying to make here. There were these famous Libet experiments, and they were experiments to see if people can control their decisions, if they are really in control. Of free will experiments they were. And we can do maybe a little version of that here. So if everybody just hold out your hand like this. Hold it out. Yeah? And now I am going to pretend to be a clock. Now you just hold it out. Yeah, I'm going to pretend to be a clock. And at a certain point, you decide just to flip your hand up. You decide. It's totally up to you. All right? But when you do, when you flip your hand, look at where the clock is. Okay? Where my clock is. My arm represents a clock. Okay. Do everybody get it? So I'm going to move around like this. And then at some point you decide, okay, I'm going to do this. My decision. All right? Here we go. And remember where the hand is. Now, how long you just do the flipping? Yeah. Whenever you feel like it, right? It's up to you. And remember where the hand was when you flipped. Everybody get it? Now, this is what they did in a Libet experiment. Something very similar to this anyway. And people who may have said, I decided, at this point, I decided to flip my hand. Yeah? At this point, the clock was at this point. That's when I decided. It was my decision. But one point I should have mentioned earlier is these people who did this, they were not just sitting in a hall. They had a brain scanner on while they did this. And the interesting thing is, they could already tell when the hand was here, the hand of the clock was here. They could already see by the brain scans that people here were going to decide. So they could tell before the people themselves decided, they could see by the brain scan already that they were going to decide to do something. Do you get it? That is awkward, right? They can just see when you're going to decide to do something. They know it before you do by looking at these brain scans. And that implies that something much deeper is in control of our decisions. This idea that we decide to do something is an afterthought, really. It doesn't instigate the action. It's a part of the action. The instigation was already much earlier before that. Yeah. Crazy, but true. If you go deep inside meditation, this is when it gets really, really, really interesting, because you can't control things anymore then. Well, we will talk about these kind of things later in detail, but that is when you really learn. You don't learn these ideas from a Libet experiment. When you really learn, as a Buddhist, to see these things like this, it's in meditation. There's a question there. In there. Yeah.
I read about an experiment where it proved that the body is at least 10 seconds ahead of the moment of aught, like precognition, so it's ahead of, yeah, it's just always ahead. So it knows what's going to happen at least 10 seconds in advance. So where does this come from? Like, where does this knowledge, where does this intuition, whatever you want to call it, what is the source of it?
10 seconds, that sounds like a long time. I remember reading something about these kind of experiments, and it was a long time indeed that they could tell. It's not just like a microsecond in advance. They could tell quite a long time in advance. I don't know if it was 10 seconds, but at least in the order of a couple seconds. But can you repeat your question again? What was it?
So if the body is that far ahead, what is the source of that knowledge? Because you're talking about decision making, like, or we think that it's I've created that decision. But if it's already written, am I just aligning myself with it? Am I just acquiescing to something greater? Or
yeah, you're basically saying what makes up the decision? Where does it come from? Well, there's a whole bunch of processes going on there, not just in the body, but mainly in the mind as well. And the more aware we are, the more earlier we can see how decisions are formed in the mind. And it's, you can't really speak of it in very abstract terms because every decision is a little bit different. But when we come to dependent origination, that is where we see the Buddha explaining one reason for decisions is... If we have ignorance, for example, the term we saw before, that is one of the underlying factors for decisions. When by ignorance we mean not really understanding life as it actually is. That leads to certain decisions. Yeah. Jake.
Yes. Commercial companies are very careful with the way they spend money. And I wonder, when we go to a supermarket and when we are reaching out for a product, maybe the difference between Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, for example, millions of dollars are spent in advertising to influence my decision as to which product to pull out from the shelf. So have I been conditioned by the advertising? Is that the reason why... You know, commercial companies put so much money into advertising because they know we can be conditioned.
Well, I don't know if they know. They probably just want to make money, and they try to figure out what ways do we make the most money, and they don't really go to a dependent origination class to learn the best way to do their advertising. So I don't think they think in those terms, but it could be that some of them think like that, but yeah. I know they have like positions on the shelf, like things on that are right in front of you. You're more likely to grab, but whether you choose Coca-Cola over Pepsi-Cola, maybe you just like Coca-Cola more.
Yeah. But, you know, I think it's a good point though what Jake is making, that obviously the reason why they spend so much money on advertising is because they know that they have at least some statistical influence on how human beings work, and it's not you cannot decide for a specific person whether it's going to work or not, but you know statistically it's going to work on a certain percentage, 20-30% or whatever, and that's enough to repay that investment in advertising here. So before you go to the shelf, you may think you decide in the last moment, but actually it was decided way down there. You said 10 seconds, Tom, but actually maybe it was even before you walked into the supermarket, 10 minutes, or a year before, yeah, when that advertisement went into your mind, it was already decided one day down the track you would choose that Coke or whatever. So I think this is kind of part of that thing, the idea that it happens a long time beforehand. It's like it's pre-programmed into you, and your body is kind of moving in that direction by itself, and then you think in the last moment, you think, oh yeah, I'll choose that one. But actually, it's already been decided a long time before. There's something like that is going on. There's a conditioning process that's far deeper. And the feeling of choice is a superficial thing that comes on top of the process of conditioning, which is not actually directly related to the choice at all. It is an additional thing on top of the choice that has been taken a long time ago.
Yeah, with things like Coca-Cola, there's also sort of an addiction kind of thing in there. You almost don't have a choice because you just crave this sugar rush or something. Yeah. So addiction is a problem that many people face. And in a way, addiction is sort of what the Buddha's saying. We are addicted to life, in a sense. That's what he's saying with dependent origination. We crave we crave to be conscious, for example. We crave to be in control. And this is also sort of like an addiction. And that it also already influences our choices, the way we are addicted to things. Yeah. Another question there, please.
Just going back to dependence origination.
Okay.
I know you'll answer this in detail during the course sometime, but just a sneak preview. Why is birth like right at the end, prior to death? It comes after consciousness and feeling and craving and everything.
This is because there's actually, when we talk about consciousness, it also implies birth already. So you could say that, yeah, after birth there will be new consciousness of a new being, in a sense. That's all implied there. But why birth is directly in front of old age and death is because once you are born, you can't avoid those things. That's the real cause of suffering, in a sense, you could say, is when you're born, you're sort of screwed, in a sense. Nobody gets out of life unscathed. Everybody will have some pain or sickness. So the suffering is given by birth. And the Buddha decided to explain it in this order. You could argue out there's more things happening between birth and old age and death, yeah? That's what you're saying. Why didn't the Buddha put more factors in there? And maybe he could have. Maybe in some suttas he does, actually, I don't know. But in the standard sequence, it just gives directly this link to indicate that once they're at birth, it's no avoiding all these problems. Well, you could to some extent avoid sorrow and grief and sadness, and you're a really happy person. You don't have those things. But the old age and death, even a Buddha would die at some point, right?
Yeah. I think one of the critical things here, as Venerable Suno says, is that once you are born, then the problem is already there. Once you're born, you're in this world, you can't do very much more. So the purpose of having birth towards the end is because you want to show why birth happens in the first place. That's why it's there. So birth is actually considered a problem in Buddhism. The problem comes towards the end, and then you show the causes that give rise to birth. So that is why you have this this particular sequence in that way. Is that what you were asking? Or are we misunderstanding your question?
I'm just missing the answer.
Yeah. Why isn't birth the first step?
Yeah.
Isn't birth the first step number one?
Yeah. Again, the reason is because once you are born, you already have the problem. Yeah. So birth is a problem because once you are born, you are into the world. So we want to find out the causes for why birth happens. Yeah. Because if you have a problem, you want to find the cause of the problem, and that's why you go before birth to ask why does birth happen? Why does this problem arise for any being? And that's why you go back before birth. Yeah? So that's actually one of the important questions the Buddha asks himself in a number of the suttas. He goes back, he starts off with suffering. Why is there old age and death and suffering? Well, it's because of birth that there is old age and death and suffering. Yeah. So why is there birth is the next question that he asks.
I get the last two steps. No problem. But
yeah.
You're saying, feeling and craving leads to birth.
Yeah. In the next life, right?
There must be birth prior to that.
Sure, of course.
That's what I mean. Why is it not like the first step and then the cycle starts from there?
Because you're trying to find the causes for birth. That's why he starts in a different place. Sure, there is birth before. You can say there's, we can make the whole sequence very simple. You can say the cause of there's death and old age. The cause of that is birth. What is the cause of that? Death and old age. What's the cause of that? Birth. What's the cause of that? Death and old age. What's the cause of that? Birth. You can do it like that if you want
that
to.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, but you want to put some more information in there because that isn't all that useful. And that information is then actually, instead of just going birth, old age, all the way back, you put in different qualities, different causes to show this in a way which is more useful to undo the whole sequence. Yeah. 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 Rebirth. Yeah.
Yeah. Rebirth will make it clear.
That helps.
To you,
yeah. Microphone,
this is a three life cycle process. I think it is in what you have written. I think I read.
Mm.
So, because there is the life, previous life, because of the asavas and avijja in the previous life, we come into the womb. And then we are reborn. And then the consciousness, what he's talking about, is there, which you have explained in your writing.
Yeah.
And then the birth, and then the following life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So would that be the way to look at it?
Absolutely, yeah. These are just different ways of thinking about the same process. Every life is just birth and death. Yeah, birth and death. And then you expand the idea of birth and death in different ways. And one way of expanding that is the links in the middle from consciousness to life, yeah, that we saw before. Yeah. Another way is the first two links, which are ignorance and then willed activities. These are different ways of looking at the same process, which is birth and old age. And the reason why you have all of these different ways of looking at it is to give you sufficient information to understand what is going on, so you can undo the process, unravel the whole thing, starting at the very beginning. If you just start with birth, you need some more information in there, and that is why it's explained in this way. So, yeah.
Yeah. So we see here, for example, a teaching that starts with craving. Here on this slide here, or actually when you focus on the gratification of things, craving increases. Now, of course, that implies birth that has happened before already. But the Buddha is trying to teach us something here. So it's not that he is trying to give like an historical perspective on how things happen, like as you said, birth and then death and then birth and then death. That's maybe how rebirth happens in, like, if you look at it from a standpoint of over time. But dependent origination is not necessarily looking at things from that perspective. It's looking at a perspective of underlying reasons for things, like birth. So what is the reason for birth? That's what the question is. Not like, what happened in the past life was this craving, but that implies that there was already a birth already. So sometimes we have to imply that certain things are already there. Does that make sense? I'm getting too technical now. Maybe that doesn't make sense, or I'll forget about it. Sorry. Sometimes I know what I want to say, but the words don't come out very well, so I'll just do my best. So we have here a shorter, I call it like a simpler version of dependent origination. It lacks some of these more complicated terms that we've seen before, like name and form and willed acts, those kind of ideas that seem a bit fuzzy, maybe a bit complicated. Here, this version seems much simpler already. You have craving, And if you have that craving, that can be the fuel, as we see here the word fuel, for a rebirth, for a new life. Yeah? And when you have a new life, there is a new birth, and then birth, there is all the suffering again. This is how this whole mess of suffering originates. So this is also saying the same principle, craving, rebirth, suffering. Do we have that pink box again? No pink box again. But that shorter version of dependent origination that we've seen there before is actually a part of the more difficult, the longer sequence, the one that people call the most deepest, difficult teaching. But we see that it can be taught much simpler by just doing those last four links that I've put in green here. You see that what we've seen here? It's actually in here. So what the point I'm trying to make is, this is in already a complete teaching in a sense that if you really, really got this, then you would be like Venerable Kondanya, see the Dhamma, if you really got this idea. But some people may not be like Venerable Kondanya. He needed even less than this, right? He needed only to hear the Four Noble Truths, and he got it. And now here the Buddha is expanding it a bit. He's putting some steps between craving and suffering. Yeah. And then maybe some people still don't get it after they hear this, and they meditate on it, of course. It's just not just hearing it, you have to reflect on it. Some people still didn't get it. All right, thought the Buddha. He thought, I will teach more. I will expand this even further. Then it came to teachings like this, you know, like the full, the difficult dependent origination. It's not really more difficult, it's just more information in a sense, because the underlying truth, the underlying principle that you see hasn't changed. Yeah, the Buddha explains it in more detail, but the things you would see if you would really meditate really deeply and let go really, really, really deeply of that craving, the things you see don't change. It's still the same insight, but it's here explained in more detail. This is really sort of like the point I'm trying to make, is that what does the understanding dependent origination, what does that mean? Does that mean we understand exactly what every of these links mean? Does it mean that we understand exactly ignorance, conditions, willed acts, conditions, consciousness? Do we need to understand all those links? Or all those links? Just more ways the Buddha tried to get us to see a deeper underlying truth. And my point is that that is the case. The Buddha is giving us more teachings here. And if you just see these teachings in very brief, they are still not very sense and don't make too much sense. So we will go into more depth later on. We will give even more teachings. Yeah. So, yeah, what is dependent origination? As Ajahn Brahmali says, you have to have this craving leads to rebirth. You have to have that in there. That's all you really need for it to be called dependent origination. And this long sequence that people usually call dependent origination is just a very expanded way of trying to explain that. I hope I'm making sense here. And if I don't, my apologies first, but I've also got another example of the same principle. This is another simpler dependent origination. And I'm just reading it out here. I know that you can read for yourself, but that gives me something to do as well. So, the current body of a fool has originated by him being obstructed by ignorance and tied to samsara, I added that, by craving. And he hasn't abandoned that ignorance nor ended that craving. Therefore, when he dies, the foolish person will move on to another body. He will get reborn, basically. Moving on to another body, he will not be freed from birth, old age, death, sorrow, grief, pain, sadness, and distress. He will not be freed from suffering. Why? Because there's the birth again is implied here. But the current body of a wise person has also originated by him being obstructed by ignorance and died by craving. So the wise person here means the enlightened one, this arahant that we meant before. The arahant, he or she, I translated as him here, but it could also be her, of course. They have a current body because in a past life they created the reasons for to be reborn. But in this life they don't have this ignorance and craving anymore, as it says there. But he or she has abandoned that ignorance and ended that craving. Therefore, when he dies, the wise person will not move on to another body. Not moving on to another body, he will be free from birth, old age, death, sorrow, grief, pain, sadness, and distress. He will be freed from suffering. And this is... I may get really boring here, but this is again the same idea. Yeah, you've got here the craving that leads to the next body, that means leads to rebirth. It's our desires, which is like fuels the process of rebirth, our craving. The Buddha says it here in different words. For those who are more sutta experts, they may see the reference, you see, the reference for the sutta is Samyutta Nikaya 12. And throughout this course, you will 12.19. Yeah, 12 is the book, and 19 is the text inside of that book. You will recognize throughout this course, we will reference this book, Samyutta Nikaya 12, which means connected discourses number 12. We will reference that a lot of times. Why? This is the book about dependent origination. All those texts we've seen before, with all the 12 links, etc., those are all inside of that collection of texts. Samyutta Nikaya means collected discourses. So all the discourses, well, most of the discourses on the dependent origination are all collected inside that book, that collection. And this one is also in there. And you see again, no mention of all these name and form kind of factors, right? But it's still explaining the same principle. What is added here, though, compared to that short version that we've seen before, this...
wrong button.
We've seen here this one. This was sort of understandable, I think. And here, there's sort of an extra principle of ignorance is also added here. Yeah, it's not just craving that leads to the rebirth. As I said before, craving leads to rebirth, but here the Buddha is teaching something extra. He's giving us another way of looking at things. He's also bringing in the concept of ignorance. It's because obstructed by ignorance and tied by craving, that is why we get reborn. Ignorance basically means not really knowing the Four Noble Truths and not living up to them. So now it's not just, Buddha's not just saying craving leads to rebirth, but it's also bringing in ignorance. Of course, the two imply each other. Because if you don't understand that craving will lead to rebirth, if you're ignorant about that, then you will do that craving. Yeah? So here we have, instead of just craving leading to rebirth, the Buddha is approaching it from a slightly different angle and saying that ignorance and craving, and we can call those, lump those together and call them like defilements of the mind, those lead to rebirth, lead to suffering. But if you have no defilements, no rebirth, then there's no suffering. You see, this is a slightly expanded way of explaining the reasons for rebirth. In the very shorter versions that we've seen before, it was just craving. Now we also add ignorance. Why does the Buddha do this? It's to give us yet another angle of approaching things, right? Because we may think in terms of craving or in terms of ignorance. This has a practical slant to it as well, a practical aspect, because you can look at your mind in different ways. You can look at it as a mind that's a craving, and you try to, in your meditation and in your life, you try to reduce that craving. Or you can look at your mind as being ignorant, as not having a full understanding of the truth, and you try to get more understanding. These are different ways of training your mind. So this is basically the Buddha giving us different tools to approach the problem of rebirth. But it's all still part of dependent origination, and just in a simpler explanation. So here we see that ignorance that the Buddha has included in that last sutta is here the first factor. We've seen that before. So now, by using those shorter, simpler suttas, we are already building up to a really complete, more complete picture of dependent origination. You see? We started out with the Four Noble Truths, then we had this slightly more complicated text with the five khandhas, yeah, where we got a bit distracted into the will thing. And now we've added this sutta that includes ignorance. And we could go on and on like this, and selecting different suttas to sort of build up the whole list of 12 factors. I'm not going to do that because we will be here for a long time. But you could do that. So now the point is, let me go to the next slide. I've put here those 12 factors in a little overview. So we've got the ignorance, the will act, etc. And I think that to most people, the sequence that is in green makes a little bit more sense. It's a little bit simpler because it doesn't have the mental aspects kind of thing. So craving, if we crave to exist, that is the fuel for there to be a next life. And the next life implies the next rebirth. And then the rebirth is old age and death. That principle, it sounds, you may not see it in very deeply, but at least it's understandable, right? The craving leads to a next life that is rebirth and old age and death. But this comes also back to this point of why is birth not in the beginning a little bit, because actually this sequence here in green is a parallel sequence to what we see on the left. It's sort of imply the same thing, and let me explain it in more detail. So that we could call the top two parts, we could call them the defilements of the mind. We've seen before that ignorance and craving, I call them the defilement. We could include in that as well the willed acts and the taking up aspects. And then the process of life and birth, actually when the Buddha mentions willed act leads to consciousness, that also implies rebirth in there. It's not at all clear when you just read willed acts leading to consciousness. It's not clear that that implies rebirth. But when you read certain suttas, and that we will quote in much more detail later on, you see that this is also a part. This is also implying rebirth. And the same goes for the last part, the old age and death, etc. That is the suffering that we've seen before. And the sense impressions and sensations also imply suffering as well. And I know if I just put it on a slide like this, it seems all a bit abstract, but we keep promising to come back to things, and we will, and then we will explain this in more detail. But my point I'm trying to make is here, those two sequences are parallel to each other. So if you would understand one, really, in you see it, then you would also understand the other one as well. So, again, we come back to the same principle. And if you don't understand all these links and these ideas that I'm trying to get across, then at least understand this, that when there's defilements in your mind, they will lead to rebirth, which will lead to suffering. And then no defilements, no rebirth, no suffering. That's a very brief teaching of dependent origination. All I'm trying to do is here make it more simple in a sense. And coming back to this point, when I first read dependent origination and read all these factors, I was like, oh, I don't understand this at all. I am not proof to be a Buddhist, because this is so difficult. But the underlying principle is actually not so difficult. Is there any more questions? Eddie? Or there's a few, actually.
Hello, yeah. My understanding of the law of dependent origination, 12 links, is that it covers three lifespans, previous life, this life, and next life. The first two links refer to the previous life. The last two refers to the next life. So if we refer, if we see the third to tenth link is this life, you know. So at the first glance, if you see 12 links together, it's very confusing, you know. So if you look into the third and tenth link, which is covered this life, then you can see it more clearly.
Yeah, there is some value to that idea. And the good thing is that it includes this rebirth, as you said, with the different lives, and which we pointed out before. That is really a central aspect that you need to have for something to be called dependent origination, is this aspect of rebirth somewhere in there. But when people limit it to the first factors, let's say ignorance and willed acts, those are in the past life only. That's a traditional interpretation. But in this life, you still have ignorance and willed acts also, right? It's not just in a past life. So the principle is more general than that. It's not just past life, this life, next life. Help me out a bit, Adam. you know what I'm trying to say.
I know what you're trying to say, yeah.
You are much more, you have better words.
Do I? We'll see what happens. The point that Vasindra was trying to make is that all of these factors also exist in the present life. The idea with the 12 links and laying it out in three lives is just to make a point how it's like an exposition. It's kind of pulling them out and putting them into three lives. But so by doing that, you're looking at a lifetime in three different ways. They're looking at it from the point of view of birth and death. That's one way of looking at life. Another way of looking at life is looking at from consciousness to existence. Are you with me, Eddie? Yeah. And then another way of thinking about life is ignorance and sankharas. And then you pull it out and you make it into a sequence of three lives. But you could turn it around. You could, for example, put birth and death first in the past life. You can make the present life into avijja and sankhara. You can make the future life into consciousness. And you can put any order of these things. Because the reality is that all 12 factors are obviously here in the present life at the same time as well. So it is just a way of having exposition that makes it clear that there is a rebirth process going on. That's why you lay it out in that way. It doesn't mean that avijja is only valid in the past life and birth is only valid for the future life. Something like that. Yeah? Happy?
Oh, no.
Oh, no? Not really? Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you happy with our comment? Yeah. Okay. Very good. Yeah.
That's not wrong with that explanation, but it's more than that.
I have a question. Just trying to understand craving. Is that tied to the second noble truth? Of craving to be, craving to get rid of, and craving to have? And how is then that tied into the sense impressions and sensations of neutral, pleasant and unpleasant?
Well, whenever you feel, we take the feelings to be ourselves. Yeah, you take the, when you feel something, you take that to be me. I feel a happy feeling. I feel etc. And because you take those feelings to be you, or at least belonging to you, it means you have a craving to continue to exist. And because this is me, I am this. I want this to continue in the future. So you have a kind of a craving to exist in the future. How we experience the world, will have an effect on our craving. Yeah. Or if somebody says, "Oh, you're a nice person," it kind of feeds you. You feel happy about yourself because somebody says you're nice, and that leads to craving to continue to exist, if you like, as that happy person. It's not just that we want to exist; it also we want to exist in a particular way. Yeah, we have this craving for these things. So sensation leads to all of these things. Or you could say if you have a lot of suffering in life, you have a really problematic life, then that can lead to a craving for annihilation. Yeah, I don't want to exist anymore. Life is just so miserable. I want to be annihilated. Of course, the most basic one is just the craving for sensual pleasure, the kamatana. Of course, if you have a happy sensual experience, then that will lead to desire for more happy sensual experiences. But let's come to these things later on, because this is kind of down the line. We're going to talk about these things in a lot of detail later on to clarify these things. So.
Ajahn, willed acts can be good or bad, wholesome or unwholesome. Do you list them all under defilements then? And some of them may not add up or lead to taking up, would they?
Yeah, some of them may not lead to taking up.
Wholesome acts. Yeah. Wholesome.
May I suggest that we take some of these questions later on, because now we're getting into the mechanics of dependent origination, and we're going to be looking at every link, like an hour, 2 hours for each kind of factor. Yeah. So let's talk about it then, because I'm afraid we're going to go too far astray. We still have quite a bit of things to go through, so we're going to kind of lose out on this material if we move too much into the future. Yeah? So if you're okay with that, yeah.
Yeah, so for now, the message we're trying to get across is just this simple message of craving or defilements, rebirth and suffering. And I found a nice picture on the internet, and I thought I'd include it here for about rebirth. See? I just thought it was really nice. Maybe that's my sense desire here, to look at a nice picture. But you see here these people dying, and then there's this infinity symbol there, and getting reborn. And they don't just get reborn as human beings, but also as all sorts of animals. I remember a song now that I used to listen to as a lay person, and had a line in there. It's a song by John Mayer, and it says, "Young and full of longing, where is this taking me? Just a great bigger eight or a tiny infinity?" So his longing, basically. He didn't have the concept of rebirth in mind, but I sometimes think about it. All this longing, where is it? All this craving, where is it taking me? Just infinity, getting reborn again and again. So we've seen before that the Buddha explained dependent origination in various ways. So why is the usual sequence? Why did he choose certain factors? Why did he choose those, and why not, for example, put birth earlier, right? He could have done that as one thing that was brought up. Or why did he not include more factors, or why did he teach these things? So why did he teach those factors? And I'll read out this little sutta here. In a rosewood forest near Kosambi, the Buddha picked up some rosewood leaves and said, he picked them up in his hand and said, "Mendicants, the monks, or the nuns as well, tell me which is more, these leaves in my hand or the leaves in the forest canopy?" Well, the answer is clear, of course, but the Buddha is going to go somewhere with this. He has this handful of leaves, and there's all these leaves in the forest. And the monks reply, "Venerable, there are just a few leaves in your hand. There are many more in the forest canopy." And the Buddha replies, "Likewise, compared to the few things I have taught you, there are many more things I know but haven't thought. Why haven't I thought those things? Because they are unhelpful and do not underlie the holy life, the spiritual life. But what have I taught you? I taught you what suffering is, what its origin is, what its cessation is, and what the practice that makes it cease is. Basically, the Four Noble Truths, which we have seen, includes dependent origination. Why have I taught those things? Because they are helpful and underlie holy life. So when we read teachings by the Buddha, it's always a good thing to reflect. The Buddha just didn't teach these things to be clever, or to just to show off what he knew. He wasn't like that. He didn't have that kind of intention at all. He instead, by all his teaching, he was just trying to be helpful, and give us something that underlies the holy life. That basically means something we can use in our spiritual practice. Yeah? So these teachings, he is giving them to us to use, and not just to as an intellectual concept. So all the teachings of the Buddha are really like tools to use. There's another sutta that gives the same idea. Teachings are weapons. And you see this guy here, this soldier, who, in my opinion, is carrying way too many weapons. He's like carrying bazooka and whatever, all kinds of weapons. I thought, this is really overarmed. So I saw this picture on the internet. I thought this is perfect for this teaching. But another monk who is from Finland, he walked by the computer while I was making this slide, and he said, "Hey, that's a Finnish soldier. I recognize all the weapons and stuff," because he used to be in the army in Finland. It's compulsory to be in the army for a year or two. And I said, "Do you guys walk around like this, you know, carrying so much weapons?" And he was, "Yes, yes." I still can't imagine it. I would say just one gun would be enough, but apparently people, they need more than one. And it's sort of the same with the teachings of the Buddha. If you're a Venerable Kandanya, maybe you just need one gun, one teaching. But other people, they may need a bit more guns, a bit more ways to approach life, more ways to reflect on life. And this sutta sort of gives you an idea of this. A frontier fort has many weapons stored up in order to protect its inhabitants and keep out the invaders. That's like noble disciples who learn much. Noble disciples in this context means everybody who is interested in the Buddhist teachings. They remember what they learn and store it in their minds. As if, like weapons are stored in a fort, but they store teachings they remember in their minds. They learn many of the teachings. With learning as their weapons, they abandon what is unskillful and blamable and develop what is skillful and blameless. So here the Buddha is saying, I give you all these teachings, again, not to be intelligent or be the wise guy. I give you these teachings as weapons. Weapons that you can use in your life to develop what is skillful and what is blameless. Everything in Buddhism comes down to practical things. So sometimes we get into technical details of some of these dependent origination teachings. But we have to always realize that teachings are weapons, and not just weapons. They are also tools. Yeah? And the more tools you have, I work a lot in the workshop in Bodhinyana, and so does Anjan Bamali. The more tools you have, the more ways of solving the problem that you're trying to fix a broken gutter or whatever. The more tools, the better. So the more teachings, the better. So teachings as tools. How do we use these tools? Right view, assisted by five factors, as liberation of mind as its fruit. What five? Ethics, learning, discussion, calm and seeing clearly. So here we see that learning and discussion, so basically learning about more tools, can lead to the right view and liberation of mind. I'm going a bit quicker now because we have to speed it up a little bit. And also here, when you recollect the teaching, your mind is not preoccupied by desire, anger, or delusion. Instead, it becomes focused on those teachings. With a focused mind, you find inspiration in the theme and its meaning. So another reason the Buddha tells us these things is not just to give information, but to actually inspire us. And it may be that some teachings don't resonate with you so much that we are going to give later on. You think, oh, this is not for me. But different things inspire different people. So this is the reason why the Buddha gave so many steps in dependent origination. And some of them you may resonate with more than others. And you don't need to have all 12 of them be as inspiring to you as all the others. Ajahn Brahmali wanted to say a little bit why the Buddha taught dependent origination, not just for tools, but also for in context, right?
Yeah, I think we should stop there, actually, because it's getting too late. Okay. But maybe instead, let's just take some few questions towards the very end. With a few more questions from overseas, and if you want to ask a couple more questions, please feel free to do so. So the first question here from Paul Westbury is asking, is the degree that we can stop the conditioning, is it limited? Is this why self-annihilation can arise? Is the degree that we can stop the conditioning limited? Now, remember the point of the Buddhist teachings is not just to stop any kind of conditioning. The point is to stop a particular kind of conditioning. And the conditioning you want to stop is the conditioning that leads to rebirth. Because rebirth is where the suffering arises. And that conditioning is the conditioning from defilements. Like when Bhasinda has been going on all the way through, the defilements, the craving, the ignorance at the root of the thing, that is the real problem. That is the conditioning you want to stop. And of course, there is no limit to that. It's just that it's gradual. You cannot overcome that conditioning straight away. You have to do it gradually. And if it goes too slow, you think, oh, taking too long to get rid of all these defilements, then you might get desperate, and then you might try to kill yourself to annihilate. You get this craving to annihilation, and then you kill yourself, and what happens? You get reborn. It's a tragedy. This is the problem. You want to end everything, and you can't. You still re-arise in the future. And this is why it is called the craving for annihilation, and why the craving for annihilation actually leads to rebirth. So it's not really a solution in Buddhism, and that's why we don't really recommend suicide as a way of ending everything, because it actually you don't actually end everything. Want to add anything, Sunyoka?
Yeah, it's also when you sometimes people think they want to stop existing to end all suffering, but is that really what they really want? They just want to be happy instead. Sometimes people may think, oh, I want to not exist, and they kill themselves, which is quite a bit of a tragedy. But maybe at the point that they die, they suddenly realize, oh, maybe I didn't really want to disappear at all, because the moment when you die is really a strong emotions come up, right? You're who you really are and what you really want to be is reflected at that moment in time. So I think sometimes people think they want to stop existing, but deep down inside, actually, they don't really.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, next one is from a fellow called Richard Beizaga, something like that. I'm not sure if I can pronounce that name correctly. But anyway, how does craving lead to rebirth? How can this be explained to a child? I found it difficult to understand. Don't know if it can be explained to a child. It might be. The child might kind of, I don't know what the child would say if you try to explain this. It might not be, but probably turn back to its Lego set and play Lego rather than paying attention. Because the way that the most simple way of thinking about how craving leads to rebirth is to remember that all craving is about the future. It's always about some future desired state, whether it is a state of existence or a state that has to do with certain sensual objects, or it is annihilation. Annihilation is also a desired future state. You want to no longer exist, or you want to exist in a zombie-like state or whatever it is. So it's all about the future. So in a sense, you are looking towards the future. You are projecting yourself into the future. And this is what craving is, this kind of movement of the mind into the future. When you stop craving, you are no longer moving into the future. You are firmly in the present moment. The mind is no longer projecting itself into the future. You don't have a vision of what you want to be. And because you don't have that projection into the future, that desire into the future, then the whole process stops as a consequence. I think that is maybe the best way of thinking about it. The problem is that this is the root insight that you have when you understand dependent origination. So this is the insight of a stream entry, a sotapanna. And because it is that, it is really, it only can be fully understood through that kind of insight. And this is part of the problem here. Anyway, we'll probably come back to that later on because it is a very important part, a core part of what this is about. The last question is from Indira Fernando. Hello, Indira. Didn't Venerable Kondanya realize the Dhamma after listening to the Anattalakkhana Sutta? The answer to that is that he realized the Dhamma. He became a stream enterer when he listened to the Dhamma Chakka Pavattana Sutta, and he became an arahant when he listened to the Anattalakkhana Sutta. Yeah, that's how it was in this, according to the sutta. So his first insight was when he listened to the first discourse, and then the second discourse is when he was able to become an arahant and a fully awakened person.
Still not having been taught dependent origination.
Still without having been taught dependent origination, exactly.
Full 12 steps. So let me just finish up really briefly with one final slide. So this is the question I have been trying to answer. Why dependent origination? Why did the Buddha teach these things? And I've addressed two things. First is to explain the Four Noble Truths. And the second point is to provide with more weapons for us to use. Yeah? So dependent origination is already an explanation of the Four Noble Truths. And all we're doing in this course is explaining the explanation, in a sense. So if you get the Four Noble Truths, then you don't really need the explanations anymore. And the third point, which we sadly didn't have too much time to do, but which we will also cover later, is that the dependent origination has certain links in there that are a bit unrelatable to us because they are a response to Brahmanism. Brahmanism was a prominent religion at the Buddha's time, and the Buddha responded to the context of society when he was alive. He didn't just teach in abstract. He taught things as a reply to what was going on around him. So some of these factors in dependent origination are responses to that, and we will explain that later. So thank you for listening. I think we have a break now.
Yeah, so we have an hour's break. Yeah. And so what do we do? Just chill? Is that the idea, Lehar? Just relax? Just have a cup of tea? Huh? Do a bit of meditation, whatever you people want to do? Huh? Just go for a walk? Yeah, yeah? Et cetera, et cetera? Huh? Yeah. So see you back at 3 o'clock. Yeah.